Come together this beautiful March day. Thank you, committee, for my Democrat colleagues for being here so enthusiastically to hear the words and pearls of wisdom that we shall embark upon. There we go. I knew it was a bipartisan committee. Senator, are you here on which bill particularly? HJR?
I just signed up to testify. Do I need to do that?
You do.
Representative Kitts, I need to request that you excuse for Thursday as I'll be both hearing a bill first at 1 and then on the road to a
road committee?
Yeah, a road committee in Eugene for human services.
And you can be excused.
So, thank you.
You're welcome.
Peter, did you catch that? I'll be excused for Thursday.
Colleagues, at this time we'll be opening a public hearing on H.J.R. 39. At this time I'll call forward Senator Morse. And Cletus, if you could read the summary, that would be wonderful.
Mr. Chair and Committee, H.J.R. 39 established a commission to create legislative redistricting plan following each decennial census. This measure is referred to the people for approval or rejection to amend the Oregon Constitution.
Thank you, Cletus. Senator, welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. I would qualify my comments today to the, at least to the extent that I'm a co-sponsor and not a primary sponsor of this bill. I would like to address my comments not so much to what the bill will do, because I believe that Senator Decker will be arriving shortly, and possibly Representative Farr will be addressing that as well. But the question I think before us today is, does the existing language of the Oregon Constitution serve Oregon's citizens well? And does it serve us as representatives of the people? Does it serve us well? And I would suggest to you, in terms of a broad, rather sweeping statement, that it does not serve us well. In fact, I believe that the existing language, in fact, in some cases, has indeed punished the citizens of Oregon, as well as us as legislators. And I would draw your attention to some language that is in implementing language in Oregon revised statutes. 188.010 deals with the criteria for apportionment for legislative assembly and Congress. And of course it's giving some meat to the bones of our Constitution. The Legislative Assembly or the Secretary of State, and I read, whichever is applicable, shall consider the following criteria when apportioning the state into congressional and legislative districts. Each district, as nearly as practical, shall be, 1, contiguous, 2, be of equal population, 3, utilize existing geographic or political boundaries, 4, not divide communities of common interest, and 5, be connected by transportation links. No district shall be drawn for the purpose of favoring any political party, incumbent legislator, or other person. No district shall be drawn for the purpose of diluting the voting strength of any language or ethnic minority group. 2 state House of Representative districts shall be wholly included within a single state senatorial district. Colleagues, this is lofty language, but in practical application, it has not, in my opinion, worked very well. We find ourselves with districts today that, as I said, punish citizens because the person chosen to represent them is not within that community of interest, is, you know, in boundaries that are extended far and wide, stretched long and thin. And I think the process, in fact, has a tremendous political partisan overtone to it. This bill would elevate that to a standard above, to the greatest extent possible, to a standard above partisanship, because it would essentially fall to the Supreme Court and identifying a commission that would represent the public in a nonpartisan way. The commissioners would not have the ability to have held a partisan political office or have changed party affiliation in the preceding 5 years, and they could not accept appointment or seek nomination or election to any elected public office during service on the commission or for 5 years following conclusion of service. So I think this bill really does, in fact, advance a nonpartisan agenda, which is what should be the case in establishing districts that really do reflect our communities of interest and, in fact, serve our citizens in a very constructive way. So, colleagues, I come today to lend support to what I think is an improvement, and would certainly ask for your endorsement of this concept and move it to the floor for a vote.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your time and being here. Are you aware if Senator Deckert is planning on coming over?
My word from Senator Deckert was that he was going to be attending, and so I'm not sure just what has held him up.
Okay, well, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that he was notified. That was my underlying concerns, that he was not aware that the bill was up today.
No, he is aware.
He is aware.
Yeah.
He is planning to be here.
Thank you, Representative Farr. Thank you, sir. Are there any questions for Senator Morris at this time? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Morris. Maybe you could clarify for me. On line 23, it says that the person can be eligible for this commission if they have not changed their political party affiliation on the person's voter registration during 5 years immediately preceding appointment. Are the commission positions based on party affiliation?
No, I don't believe that's the intent. I believe that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I believe that the intent of this is that you would not find someone changing their affiliation and putting essentially a cloud on, you know, their qualifications to serve. That would be my reading of that. I would defer to Representative Farr's interpretation as well.
Well, I think that the idea is that someone wouldn't change their political party specifically to be appointed to the commission so that they could sway the decision in another way. The idea was that there would be equal representation.
So there would be positions. Sorry.
Follow up.
I think in answer to your original question, right, it would be, let me tell you exactly what it would be. I'm sorry, I'm looking to see where exactly that is in my notes, but it would be a five-person commission, and so there would be two members from the Democrat Party, two members from the Republican Party, and then the fifth member could be of any other political party.
This is your assessment.
But it would definitely take the politics out of redistricting, and that was the idea behind it.
Gladys, did you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, if you look on page 2 of the measure, paragraph 4, Dr. Millett defines the breakdown that Representative Farr is referring to in terms of the two parties and the unrelated party, and the purpose there is to make sure people don't switch to change the odds of who's on there.
Well, 1 second, Representative. I know that Representative Dalto's got a question. Senator Deckert, Senator Morris has already testified. Do you wish to sit with him and then maybe feel any questions that they may have, or do you want us just to finish with Senator Morris and then?
I enjoy sitting with him.
Well, if you enjoy it, then I'd prefer for you not to do it.
Well, actually, Senator Deckert approached me today and he said, "Will you be able to testify?" And I said, "Well, I'll try."
I'll join them.
And
okay.
He said, "Well, no, you will be there." And now I thought maybe I understood why, because maybe he wasn't going to come.
He can let you soften the blows up. I understand, Senator Deckert. Is very skilled. Representative Farr will be joining the panel since they are the main and co-sponsors of this. I'm going to let the two other new members joining the panel testify, and then we'll open up for questions in the name of expedience, because I love expedient committees. Please go ahead, Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the House Rules Committee, thank you, A, for having us up before you. Before you have, what we try to do when we set up the two bills that we've introduced, this group, and Senator Morris, Representative Farr, Representative Hass, and myself, and Representative Lim was a part of the group, we introduced two bills. One is, which started in the Senate, which is an open primary, nonpartisan legislature, and then we introduced this bill, which would be a nonpartisan redistricting commission bill. The spirit of the bills, Mr. Chair, is really how do we remove as much as we can, and I know this is a difficult task, but politics from the good work that we do and elevate the questions that we have to the highest possible level. And when we looked around the country, we found, especially with redistricting that we just went through in the last census, that if you look at the redistricting process, both congressionally and in the states, that where you had these nonpartisan commissions, they tended to be better reflective of communities of interest. And so you held together those communities of interest better in the states that had the nonpartisan redistricting commissions. Where you didn't have that, you tended to have more, for lack of a better word, gerrymandering. And it's certainly not 100% one way and 0% the other way, but just in general, that's what we found. And so we bring this bill to this committee for your consideration as one step I think we could take, along with hopefully open primaries and a nonpartisan legislature that would really, I believe, elevate the discourse and the way that we handle issues here in Oregon. I certainly think you would find a redistricting process that really meets that tough, tough standard of communities of interest and reflects that with the bill that you have before you. It sounds like y'all went into the details. We have them before us in my written testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well,
I
really didn't go into details.
Oh? Do you want me to hit the details?
Love to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The commission would be established to provide for redistricting of state legislative districts. It must be established no later than January 31st of each year, ending in one. The commission would consist of retired state and federal judges who have served in Oregon, and we really borrowed heavily from Governor Schwarzenegger, who is in California proposing a similar model for California redistricting, of who are those folks out there that could really be the dispassionate arbitrators of a political decision. And we settled on retired judges, but would be open to what changes or what thoughts the committee has. The Supreme Court would identify the qualified persons and select five at random. Selected judges would be randomly excused and reappointed until the panel consists of members registered with two or more political parties, with two members belonging to each of the two largest political parties. The commissioners cannot have held a partisan political office. They cannot have changed party affiliation in the preceding 5 years, and they would have to accept appointment or seek nomination, cannot accept appointment or seek nomination or election to any elective public office during service on the commission for 5 years following the conclusion of their service. And so that's pretty evident what we're trying to get at is we're really trying to get at those folks that are not in the line of work that we're in. They are judicial by nature and arbitrators by nature. Three votes would control the outcome. It would have to happen after redistricting year on June 1st. On the first business day following the plan's adoption by the commission would then submit the plan to the Legislative Assembly. The Assembly would have 30 days to amend the plan by a two-thirds vote in each chamber. Then the plan is final upon adoption of amendments by the Legislative Assembly or expiration of the time allowed for amendments. The operative date would be October the 1st for the plan. So it brings the legislature in, but really is deferential to the judges who are given most of the power in terms of unless you can get two-thirds vote. If the commission fails to adopt the plan by June 1st, the commission is dismissed, and the Legislative Assembly would then, we'd have more of a status quo environment. The final plan, again, is then operative on October the 1st. If the Legislative Assembly fails to adopt a plan by July 1st, the Supreme Court establishes a new commission, which then would have to adopt a plan by August 1st. The plan is final and becomes operative by October 1st. The new commission fails to adopt a plan, the Supreme Court shall adopt a plan that becomes operative by December 15th. And then a two-third affirmative vote of each chamber, the Legislative Assembly may adopt laws to reconvene affirmative vote using three members of the commission. The redistricting plan or amendments to the plan are not subject to veto by the governor, and the Legislative Assembly must appropriate monies for the operation of the commission and can adopt additional rules to govern the commission. So those are the details, Mr. Chair. The only thing I would ask is we hold this model up against the status quo and those of us that were here for the redistricting. My two cents on it was, and I was a little bit surprised, it tended to be just kind of more, certainly the legislative debate was how would it affect my particular district? And I think in some ways we lost sight of, and in 2010, hopefully this doesn't occur, we lost sight of, what do we want the state as a whole to look like, both congressionally and in state legislative districts? Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Senator. Representative?
Well, my comments would be my goal, as is I'm sure all of our goals, is to be sure that constituents are truly represented. And the idea with districting is that you are representing a section of the populace that shares your views and probably in general shares each other's views. The issues that are important to them are really based on where they live in the state. And rural issues are definitely different than urban issues. There are certain urban issues in the city that I live in, the beautiful city of Eugene. In fact, the district that I represent is quite different than Representative Holvey's district. It's difficult when you have a district that's carved out of different sections and different groups of voters with different issues to really represent them the way they should be represented.
Can you state your name for the record?
For the record, my name is Debbie Farr, and I'm state representative for District 14.
Thank you very much. I think Senator Morris, you did for the record.
I need to state my name for the record, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Frank Morris, state senator from District 8.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Sorry, I should have caught you prior to that. Are you done, Representative?
That's all of the testimony I have, but we're available for questions.
I appreciate your availability. I think Representative Dalto had a question, then Representative Greenlink had a question.
Actually, Mr. Chair, my question was answered by the good Representative Washington County.
Thank you, Representative.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. Senator.
Senator. He's a representative of Washington County.
I'm reading sub 4 on page 2, line 3, differently than you're reading it. Let me try my interpretation and see how it reads to you. It sounds to me like this. Supreme Court names 5 members plus 5 alternates. There are only 2 conditions under which those members change. 1, if the court appoints 5 members who are registered to vote as members of the same party. Or 2, if a panel in which none of the members is registered to vote as a member of the 2 largest political parties. Then the court makes a change. Other than that, it stands. So the idea, I mean, if I'm reading it correctly, the idea that you keep going till you get 2 of each would only be operative if there were these 2 very weird first selections. Now, do you read that differently? And I'm reading it right?
Well, I certainly wouldn't, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenleaf, I wouldn't declare myself an expert in interpreting this language, but it appears to me that the intent of this is to select a field of candidates from which there's not been an identification of party affiliation. And out of that, then, there has to be essentially a balancing. And of those that are selected, if they are not in the balance that is mandated, then it's by lot, and they're drawn again until you finally do get that balance. And that's the way I would read that provision.
We've had some recent experience with a measure that passed that the intent was different than the words, and I think in this case, if that is the intent, and I trust it is, that I think the words are wrong.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlick, we would be happy to. And I know what we're trying to get at. We leaned heavily on the California proposed statute.
Yeah, that's Schwarzenegger.
Which, if done correctly, I think is a good model. I mean, my two cents would be, I think that is a good model to find judges who are practicing this, retired. It just seems to me it passed the smell test for me. But we would be happy to, and I would be happy to sit with you if there's some wordsmithing that you think would better accomplish that goal of getting kind of a representative judicial.
Yeah, no, I don't think you need to sit with me. I think you need to sit with LC. I mean, I think if all you're trying to say is you need five members, you look at them, and you just keep going one by lot until you get two and two, that's a straightforward thing, and I think it'd be easy for them to make that say that. And I think that is. I think it does make sense.
I think the committee is clear on the intent of the language, maybe just not exactly that the language is saying what you intended it to say. So, Senator or Representative, I have two questions. I don't care who answers them. Using the Supreme Court as a model by whom will garner this qualified fool, the Supreme Court in and of itself by nature is a political it's a political body. Do you think that by having them be the figurehead or the by which everything else runs through, do you think that ends up kind of being a conflict to what obviously is your intent of the bill? That's my first question, so I'll let you take that one. Why the Supreme Court, knowing the political nature by which it exists?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know of any other body within this state that would be elevated to the stature of the Oregon Supreme Court. Granted, people are human, and it'd be virtually impossible to eliminate any sense and all sense of a political maybe persuasion. But these are folks that they just hold that stature. And if we were to assign to some group the responsibility to select the commission, which would then in turn make the determinations of where these boundaries would lie, I don't know of any other group that would be higher on that scale and above reproach than the Oregon Supreme Court.
Thank you, Senator. The only other one that I could think of would be the Elections and Rules Committee of the State House of Representatives. My esteemed colleagues.
That conceptually.
If the committee's not opposed to that, we can move forward with that. Senator, the second question that I had is within the pool of people that you're identifying here as the qualified ones, people, any idea what that number is? You know, when you specify the person is eligible to be appointed as a member of the commission, if the person, you know, and you go on to list these things, it seems like that's a pretty narrow group of folks. Any idea what that number would consist of eligible folks that fall into those criteria?
Ask your question again, Representative or Chair Kibbs. I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
You've outlined in your bill, it says a person is eligible to be appointed as a member of the commission if the person, fulfills these criteria that you've outlined in what appears to be 20, lines 20 through 30. My question, it seems pretty narrow in focus of who qualifies or who would be qualified to serve on this commission. Any idea the number of people that I mean, you're talking specifically state or federal retired judges. I mean, there's, you're really narrowing it down. I'm just curious, with the narrow specifications that you've put in here, what does that pool mm-hmm. of people amount to? I would imagine not pretty big.
Yeah.
Am I being clear enough, or do I need to restate it in a different way?
No, Mr. Chair, I think you're very clear. You're correct in the sense that, I mean, in some ways modeling it after California, who would have more judges to choose from, that this, I think we would be open to, we're looking for, although I think you might find that would be interesting to, for folks who are going to testify after us, that might be interested in this, how big of a pool that is, and is it something that you would want to, if you're interested in the concept, this is a good body to actually adjudicate these cases. How do you grow, if needed, so that there is a big enough pool? I mean, to me, I would think, and this is just off the cuff, you would want to have, just so you have a big enough pool to select from, 40 or 50 or 60 different individuals that would fit that bill, just so that you've got enough folks to sift through to find the right five. Now, I should say, and it was kind of on your previous question, one model we looked at for this, and at least discussed quickly, was a model where you would have the parties manifested in the majority leaders of both the House and then minority leader, majority leader, minority leader. Each would have one representative, so you'd have four. And you'd give some guidance to try to get them to pick someone that's not at least overtly political, but they're obviously going to appoint someone that represents their political point of view. Those four would then have to pick a fifth and agree upon a fifth. Right. Now, that's a different model where you would basically sit those four in a room. Each person then knows their role. I represent the Senate Democrats. This person represents the Senate Republican point of view. Then those four would have to come together and find that neutral fifth who ultimately would be then very empowered in the redistricting process, because that's the one they've come up with as a neutral party in this. That is a model to consider. I would say this is a better one of trying to find folks who are really outside, hopefully, of the world that we live in here. I would argue for this over that, but that is another option that this committee would have if it chose to go in that direction.
Senator, one final question from me, and then I know that Representative Holby and Representative Greenlee have a question. The way that it's currently written, and I want to make sure that I'm reading it correctly, is it possible that you could have four Democrats or four Republicans, interchange, I don't care, and one of the other, for example, could you have four Republicans and one Libertarian on this five-person commission? Would that?
No.
I think we say major political parties. I don't know if they're defined as one of the two major political.
So could you have four Republicans and one Democrat?
I don't believe so.
No, it specifically states, let's see, consisting of members registered with two or more political parties with at least two members belonging to each of the two largest political parties in the state.
So it'd be two Republicans, two Democrats, with the fifth to be random. Random.
Unaffiliated.
Independent.
Thank you. I misread that. I apologize. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, if the Chair would indulge me with both of them. The first question is, I'm reading this, and am I correct that there would be a new commission established every time there was redistricting? This commission isn't appointed for life or anything like that? That's correct. And my second question is, basically, I don't have the history of the last redistricting being in the legislature, and wondering, you know, what is wrong with the system we have now that lends us to go to a major change in our Constitution in this direction. So I'm kind of curious what the problems with our system is that has the legislature and the Secretary of State doing this, and you know why this bill is important for us.
I'd like to say one thing, and then I'll pass off to Representative Farr. To me, and Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think that's an important question, especially for folks on our side of the political aisle. This bill in no way is a comment on Oregon's redistricting process or the Secretary of State and the way that it worked out, 4 years ago. to me, the spirit of it, and it's married with the other bill that we're introducing, which is starting in the Senate, which is open primaries in a nonpartisan legislature. The spirit behind it is if I think you, I believe in the last 10 or 15 years, which probably is my entire adult life, you've seen a coarsening of the political process. And it's manifested itself in redistricting is one way. But I also think we caucus too much, and that's where next, I think we're up in Senate rules on a different bill, on nonpartisan, to talk about the ways that I feel our political process is coarsened, and the debate is not as elevated as it possibly could be. And so I think this model, as you kind of survey around the state, in Washington or Arizona that have commissions like this, and Nebraska, who has a nonpartisan legislature, I just feel, on the whole, I would argue, those are better forms. Those are aspirations that I would hope for our state. Because I think the debate, and I'll take a bill that Representative Greenlick's working on, this OHSU-PSU merger, that is a very interesting, important debate for the state to have. And I would want, not that politics get injected all the time, but any time politics are injected in these decisions, I just think it's unfortunate, because that is a critical debate about the future of our higher education system.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Felto, did you have a question?
No, I did not.
Mr. Chair.
A third question?
I wanted to follow.
You may follow up.
Thank you, Mr.
On a question-by-question basis from here on out.
I have a question of any of you. Is that, you know, I applaud the effort to make this a more nonpartisan effort, but I just am curious how we determine whether this commission is going to do a better job than the system we have now. And I guess that's what's sort of bugging me with this a little bit. I'm kind of wondering what's going to make this commission better than the system we have now. And anyway, I'll leave. I don't know if you can answer that or not, or whether that's a comment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, I would tend to be just a little bit more direct than my colleague, Senator Deckard. This is a very partisan process. There is no denying it. We just as well call a spade a spade. It is absolutely partisan. And does that serve Oregon well? I think that's the question. You know, it's a specific example. Someone that lives in Foster, Oregon, which is just east of Sweet Home, being represented by a senator from Molalla. Is that serving that citizen well? Or does it facilitate the ability of that senator to serve people in Foster, Oregon? And I think that's a very valid question. And that has been replicated. You know, it's not just this Secretary of State, but it's a process that is, by its very nature, a very partisan-driven process. And the question is, can we or should we attempt to improve it? And I think that's the fundamental issue here, is can we elevate this to the status where, to the highest degree possible, there is not an underlying agenda, but it truly is, how do we structure this so that citizens are represented in communities of interest, and that we can do it better than what we're currently doing it. And so I tend to be, Mr. Chair, just a little bit more direct in this issue. There's no reason to candy coat it in any other way. It's how do we take it from a very partisan-driven process to the greatest extent possible, a nonpartisan process.
Thank you, Senator. Representative March, go before Representative Greenlick, since he hasn't asked a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to put this a little bluntly as well. Senators and Representative, have either one of you designed a plan for the 60 House districts of Oregon using the 2000 census data and coming up with 60 perfect or nearly perfect House districts, and 30, then joining those together to create 30 perfect Senate districts? You're nodding your heads. You've done that.
Well, it's a good question. I was nodding my head because you're right. I mean, there's no perfect world. Representative, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative March. There's no perfect world, and we're certainly not suggesting that that the next redistricting is going to be perfect in any way. There's undoubtedly going to be some flaw somewhere along the line. But I think that both of the senators said it very well. Senator Morris didn't sugarcoat his comments, and not to say that Senator Deckert did, but I do believe that whatever political party is in the Secretary of State's office, there is going to be some partisanship. You know, it's just inherent in the system. The idea was for the next redistricting, it could be a different political party that occupies that office. That's why we're all here together.
We're hopeful.
Follow up. Mr. Chair, can I just say one thing? Because I was nodding, because I think that's an excellent question of why is this going to be any different than what we've experienced? And I think I would not want to be on this Judicial Commission. Obviously, I don't meet the criteria. But I would only argue that it would be better on the whole if we can remove ourselves just temporarily from the seats that we hold. And as Oregonians look at reforming the political system, and I think the other bill that we introduced is also in that same vein, I just think this would be a better process. And obviously the voters would get their chance to weigh in on this, but I would just argue that it's a better process by removing folks with such a vested interest in the outcome and getting us away from it, at least at arm's length.
Well, yes. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've been working on redistricting and reapportionment issues since 1971. And in 1973, the Supreme Court of California appointed just similar commission, in essence, a panel of special masters to do the redistricting. When that plan came out, it was challenged by both sides as being partisan. I want you to rethink this a little bit. Try taking the requirements of ORS 188 and plugging them into a data system with the Census Bureau data and seeing what you come up with, because every plan has a flaw. And most plans have many flaws. And I'll tell you, I was not particularly in favor of the Secretary of State's plan when it came out. I thought it had several flaws. But it didn't have a lot of other flaws. For example, you talked about legal boundaries, cities and counties. There are no cities that are under the size of a house district that are split in that plan. I thought the Secretary of State went to great pains to ensure that cities under 57,000 were not split. It joined some cities together that had been split into multiple Senate districts before, like Gresham, put them all in one district. There are flaws in any system. And in fact, if you look at the commission system, the committee administrator was kind enough to give us the Shifting Sands redistricting law, and it notes a few legal cases in here. I note Colorado and Pennsylvania. They're two of the 12 states that have commissions, and those were challenged all the way up into federal courts for partisan gerrymandering. So look carefully at what you're asking for. There's no perfect system. There's no perfect reapportionment plan. And if you go this route, you've got nothing in here about letting the public into this process, about having public hearings. How does the public influence this process? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And I would just, with regard to no city under 57,000 having been split, I can tell you the city of North Plains, population 1,700, has three different state representatives, two of whom are on this committee. Okay. So,
how much has it grown since?
It's still under 2,000 people.
Representative Dalto.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Representative Greenlee.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. With the greatest possible respect to my good colleague from Portland, first of all, the public had an extensive opportunity to participate in the legislative redistricting process, which occurred in 2001. I participated as a member of the public. Many other people participated as members of the public, and we still got a state senate district that goes from Kaiser to Hillsborough. We've got a my house district, which slices down through the center of Salem and joins some very, very different communities, even within this city. We've got a district that goes from Woodburn, all of which you know, but a district that goes from Woodburn to North Salem, based on the justification, if you read what the Secretary of State's office had prepared, because they share a community of interest of a clinic that some residents of Woodburn come down to North Salem to visit and play soccer at some of the soccer arenas in North Salem. And so you had, in some cases, very, in my estimation, this person's opinion only, very narrow and very thin justifications for the community interest standard. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not convinced that the public has an opportunity to participate. They did have an opportunity to participate. I'm not convinced that what occurred in 2001 was anything close to actually taking some of those concerns, valid concerns, into consideration. But I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, have a comment on the heterogeneity of districts, but I won't. I'd like to raise an issue in addition. My sense is that we're thinking about amending this and moving it in some ways. And one of the things that troubles me a little bit about this compared to where we are now is the question of the length of time of the process. This process can carry much longer than the current process. The current process is the legislature does it by July 1st, I think. And if they don't do it by July 1st, it goes to the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State does it by September 1st, maybe. I mean, there's a very specific timeline. There's time to challenge it in the court. This one can still be running as late as the 1st of December, and that worries me a little bit. Do you see that as being a problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I know I would be, and I want to speak for my colleagues here, flexible in terms of ensuring the quickest adjudication of it. If we need to bump it up. Miley, the only sentiment that I have on the conversation that we just had is this is our one. If we want to do something different with redistricting going forward, this year's our chance, I would argue. Because I think once you move into, you get closer to 2010, I think forces beyond our control will kind of lock in the status quo. And that's fine. I mean, we know that world. So if we wanted to do something, I'd be happy to work to refine this plan. I think that's a good suggestion in terms of the dates. Maybe you do want to move it up and set a firm date. Because the courts, and Representative March's point is a very good one, is I think you're going to have challenges. I think you're going to have folks unhappy no matter who does it. But who got me interested in this was former Secretary of State Clay Myers, who lived in Oregon, was Oregon Secretary of State for years and years, and lived in Arizona in his final days. And they had a redistricting commission. He was the one that called me many times in the last year and advocated for what he thought was a better process. Not a perfect, still huge problems, but just a better public process. And Representative March is correct, too. We need to build the public into it then. You need to have the public hearings. But that's what I think we're trying to offer up today is certainly you will have no arguments. This is perfect. It solves what is one of the toughest issues we face is redistricting. But I think this would just be perhaps a better way to go about it than what we'll gear up for if we don't pass this in about 3 or 4 years.
Senators and Representative, do you have a follow-up?
I do have one.
Please.
It'll just
be the last
brief
one.
Comment. I was kind of appalled by the Texas situation, which 4 years after the time redistricting. I mean, and I don't care which side did it. That seems to be a bad thing. Is there anything in here that would assure that districting only is going to happen once every 10 years? I mean, that's enough, it seems to me, isn't it?
I think the safeguards would be in there because of the commission form that you're giving authority to. But if we needed to put an explanational point on that, the Texas example would be a good one for me of where you had a process that was just completely hijacked by politics. And I think this would help avoid that, hopefully.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and thank you, Senators. The intent of your bill is commendable. It's going to be a long road, but I know you all are willing to travel that road. So thanks for being here, and I think it's been a great discussion today. Appreciate it. It's Kathy Eaton at this time.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The equitable and fair apportionment of legislative representation is a very serious matter. In fact, it's one of the cores of our democratic government. Under Oregon law, the decennial redistricting process and the plan is assigned to the legislature for enactment during the session immediately following the U.S. Census. When the legislature fails to agree on a redistricting plan by July 1st, the process goes to the Secretary of State with strict deadlines for plan development and review by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court actually does make the final decision as to whether that redistricting plan is in line and can then be forwarded to the federal government as having been done. Partisanship has played a major role in the legislature's inability to agree on an apportionment plan in the recent decades. The League's concern centers on both who is involved in the process and the criteria in place for making the decisions. HJR 39 would establish a commission comprised only of retired judges and appointed by the Oregon Supreme Court. There is no opportunity for public members on the commission, as Representative March has already pointed out. And there is not a guarantee that opportunities for public input would be provided. The current process allows for public hearings during the legislative session, and that's what occurred in the 2000 legislature's discussion of a redistricting proposal, and during any plan which is developed by the Secretary of State. While population is the basic factor for redistricting, other criteria also are important, as mentioned by Senator Morse, but we, I think, would underline them a little more than he did. Their contiguous lands, the concern about minorities, the segments of mutual interest, and the growth patterns of the areas which are being redistricted. On a personal matter, I worked with then Secretary of State Clay Myers on a group he put together to look at redistricting 30 years ago. And then I was privileged to sit on the commission which Secretary of State Phil Kiesling put together in 1991 to look at redistricting when the 1991 legislature was unable to agree on a redistricting plan. That was a very interesting experience, and it involved a wide segment of people. There were 11 of us on that commission, and that was the first time that a computer was used to look at the mapping of the state and the districts and how you could move populations around. And we went around the state holding hearings so that people could come and talk. I remember one that was held in Eugene where we actually went around to neighborhoods to see how the redistricting would affect the core of interest of people that were that close together. It was an extremely interesting process, and the challenges were very limited to that plan when it went to the Supreme Court. And in fact, Oregon was among the first three states that agreed upon a redistricting plan in 1991. We met the deadline very, very well, but it was a very good open process. The League isn't taking any position at this point on HJR 39, but we do caution the committee to carefully consider the ramifications of this measure. While we all would like to avoid the contentious and divisive redistricting problems of 2001, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater in our desire to change the procedures. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Eaton, I had a question about your comments reflecting back to the 91 process and how well you felt that worked. How well did you feel the 01 process compared to the 91 process?
Well, it was different, obviously. I can't remember specifically, Representative Daltu, whether or not there was a citizen commission that was involved with that process. I think there were some people involved. I do know that the legislature had more of an opportunity in 2001 because, again, there was technology that was available, and I remember that set up around this building were computers where you could go in as a legislator and fiddle around with things to look at. You didn't like the shape of that or how many people were going to be there. And I do believe, and the league believes, that the process that was used by the legislature to try to put it all together was a good one, but you simply couldn't agree because of the partisanship that took place. One party didn't like it the way this was this way. The other party didn't like it because of that, and that's why it went to the Secretary of State. But I think that the technology was available if the legislature had been able to go get over their disagreements, that the process that they went through was a good one.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Walton.
Thank you. And so so once the legislature was unable to come to an agreement, actually, the legislature did agree. The governor vetoed the legislative
package. Well, I was going to say, yes. It
so
was.
Once the governor vetoed the legislative package and the responsibility fell upon the Secretary of State, how well do you feel that the 01 process at the Secretary of State's level ran compared to the 91 process?
I can only comment from my own observation of it, Representative Dalto. I know that there were hearings held around the state. I know there were opportunities for people to discuss it. I think there were more challenges to it. And I think that was representative of the way in which the state was divided. In the long run, from what I've been able to ascertain, the districts that were established with that process were fairly fair. That's my own comment.
One final follow-up. So you don't have to answer this, but fairly fair that we have a district that goes from Kaiser to Hillsborough? I don't think that's very fair. But my last question is, and you can address, feel free to address that, but my last question is, in terms of the process as completed by the Secretary of State in the 01 cycle, it was a marked departure from what happened in 1991, in which my understanding and my belief of what occurred in 91 was that existing districts were taken, the information of the census was provided, and the existing districts were adjusted to accommodate the population changes based on the 1991 session. And so you did not have any changes in districts from the 81 process to the 91 process with respect to much geography, mostly just adjustments for population. And in the 2001 cycle, the Secretary of State's office took it up and completely renumbered the state and completely redrew the district, the geography of the districts, many districts, and the examples, effectively drawing certain legislators out of their own districts. And there are four or five examples of that where legislators were placed into the same district as another legislator. So they threw out the districts that were already existing and created new ones. And so I just wondered how the league, what the league's position on that approach was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, I can't speak to that because we weren't involved with those processes that took place, and we did not evaluate it. I will say that in 1991, there were a couple of districts at that point which were as egregious as the ones that you're talking about now that were taken care of. I know we had one district that ran from Eugene up, way up north, and that got reconfigured in 1991. When I speak on a personal basis for my experience in 91. I did not have the same experience in 2001. And so to answer your question a little more fully, the League was involved in public hearings in 2001 to try to ensure that the basis of population and the interests of people and the minorities were considered in that plan. That's the extent of our involvement.
One final question. Thank you.
Final follow-up.
Thank you for indulging me, Mr. Chair. And so I hear you saying a couple of different things, and it's a little bit confusing, I think. You said that the League participated in the 01 cycle, the 01 process, to ensure that populations were protected and that demographics and other issues were respected and that people maintained their voice. But I also heard you say that the League did not evaluate the effectiveness of the redistricting process overall. And so I'm at a loss as to understand your opposition to the League's opposition to this, or the concerns about this, to this bill that is under consideration this morning or this afternoon, if you didn't even evaluate the 2001 process to the extent that you would need to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, we have no position on HJR 39. We're simply are presenting comments to you about the need to move carefully with whatever you do and not to leave the public out of the process. And we do not see that there's public process protected in this particular proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Eaton, would the League be more comfortable with this bill if we did add in an amendment that allowed for public hearings? Because I think that both of the senators and myself were a little surprised that that wasn't indicated in the bill.
Certainly. We'd certainly give that consideration, Representative Carr. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathy. David Buchanan, Common Cause.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is David Buchanan. I'm the state chair of Oregon Common Cause. Common Cause has a national set of guidelines dealing with redistricting. And these are suggestions, not mandates. These are just things to enable the process to work and to work in the best way according to our viewing of the process. In these guidelines, the first one is who does the work. The second one is what are the criteria. The third one, public participation and transparency, that's one that the previous speaker had mentioned is not part of this bill but should certainly be added. The fourth one and the fourth one frequency and the fifth one judicial review are also both covered in this bill. As somebody who's kind of watched redistricting for a very long time, I have a prejudice in favor of the current system. The current system came about because of necessity. During the first half of the 20th century, the legislature was very loath to redistrict and did it very rarely and very grudgingly, apparently. After the 1951 census passed with the legislature not taking action, a man whose name you've heard before, Clay Myers, was then the head of the state Young Republicans, and he got the head of the Young Democrats to join with him, and they created an initiative that set in motion redistricting process. And that passed, I think it was 1954 was when that passed, and after that mandate from the voters required the legislature to redistrict, the Oregon legislature did do a good job of it in 1961. In fact, so good that when the 1963 Supreme Court decision, Baker versus Carr, was handed down. 49 states had to redistrict. Oregon didn't because we had done it. And so the time for Oregon to shine was then. We were the best redistricted state in the nation. And that was because we'd had an initiative that forced the legislature to act. The process as it has worked in the succeeding years, 71, 81, 91, and 2001, has generally worked, and I think worked well. There have been some rough edges, but part of the answer to that has been there's always been a fallback. When this fails, this happens. When this fails, this happens. So that timeline, that sequence of July 1st, August 1st, September 1st, all of those dates have worked well to get the process working and accomplished. Now, there's always disagreement about what the end result has been. And this bill wants to make the most major change is who does the work. And I'm not opposed to the legislature having the first crack at it, which is what this bill turns it around. The commission would go first and the legislature would kind of have a slight chance to do something. If a vast majority of the legislature were to agree, they would have some input at some point later in the process. I'm not sure that maybe it isn't better to have the legislature take the first crack, give them that kind of absolute deadline, and if they fail, then turn it over to somebody. And I think it would be better to turn it over to a commission rather than to a single a person like the Secretary of State. The Secretaries of State that have done redistricting, I think, have done a commendable job in getting the process done. It's really a big task sometimes. Now in the days of computers, I guess it's more pushing buttons than it was in the earliest days of maps and calculators, adding 3 in this census tract, 7 in this census tract, 9 in this census tract. Anyway, I think that the nonpartisan commission is a good and viable idea, and whether it's the initiator or whether it's the backup for failure of the first step in the process is really a good chore for the legislature to wrestle around and figure out how they would prefer it. But who it is that the nonpartisan commission is creates some problems. And Representative Greenlick, I read that sentence, that very obtuse sentence, exactly as you read it. And to me, that sentence is completely different than what the intent of the authors are seeking. I read it that there were only 3 rather unusual circumstances that would trigger the rebalancing of the committee. If it was all 5 Democrats, all 5 Republicans, or none of the 5 Democrats or Republicans, those were the only options that triggered that rebalancing. I think that it would be much clearer if they simply stated what the goal was and mandate that the process of random drawing occurs until the 5 positions are filled according to the parameters of what that position has to be. The first one could be anything, the second one could be anything, the third one could be anything except if the first 2 were the same. I mean, it would be easier to kind of say, here are the 5 positions, here's the random drawing process until it meets the criteria of filling those 5 positions within the parameters that have been designed for it. That if this happens, then triggers this is kind of backwards, I think. At any rate, actually, I think more important than who does the work is what their criteria are. And in this list of guidelines, the criteria are pretty basic. Equal populations, complying with the Constitution, the Voting Rights Act, boundaries that respect communities of interest, and geographically compact and contiguous. And because the population can be exact, the compliance with the federal laws can be determined. The Justice Department lets states know when they're not in compliance.
David, I'm going to have to ask you to
yes.
Speed up. And just don't. The committee has your written testimony.
Oh,
I've allotted 1 hour for this, and we're 3 minutes past that right
okay.
now.
Okay. So variables are very great, and as Representative Dalto pointed out, a community of interest can have an infinite number of definitions, and it's hard to say, well, this community of interest is greater than that. But the important factor, I think, that should be considered is districts should be competitive. That's a tough thing to do. It's going to be the basis of all kinds of arguments as to what is competitive. But that's, I think, the goal. If the goal is to make the legislative districts competitive as possible, accounting for the other parameters that are somewhat variable, that, I think, should be the goal. And if a nonpartisan commission can be tasked with the idea of making the districts as competitive as possible, that, I think, is the goal it should be aimed for. And I'll suspend, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them and try to make the answers brief.
David, thank you so much for being here, and I think that your written testimony is very, very thorough and comprehensive and appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you want to have a work committee, I'd be perfectly happy to be part of it.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just make a quick point on that competitive district. In the center of Portland, it's very hard to find a competitive district anywhere you draw a circle of 57,000 people. So.
Right. And
so we're working on that, Representative.
That would be a factor that would be weighed into the variables. The infinite number of variables should be able to produce an answer that is both competitive and meets all of the other requirements. And I agree that there are some areas where it would be less so than others.
Great.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
This time we'll close the public hearing on HJR 39. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3343. Sorry to wake you up. I do apologize. Do you have any members? Representative Thatcher, we'll allow you or call you to be the first to testify. Cletus, could you please read the summary?
Mr. Chair and committee members, HB 3343 requires ballots to contain designation, quote, none of the above, unquote, in addition to names of candidates for the election to public office. Requires ballots to contain a designation, none of the above, in addition to yes and no for each measure.
Representative Thatcher, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kim Thatcher, representing Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And I think my comments will be less than the description of the bill, shorter than the description of the bill. But none of the above. This is the entity or person, if you will, that a lot of people would prefer voting for during an election. Some people will write in a fictitious candidate if they are not pleased with the choices presented. Some people will vote for two or more of them in an effort to cancel out their own votes. Some will write none of the above most emphatically all over their ballots, as I witnessed in Yamhill County Elections Office in a recent visit. And many will leave their ballot blank in places where they just don't want to choose any of the candidates. But all these methods of voting by an elector boil down to one message, and that's, I don't like any of the choices here, therefore I would prefer not to vote for any of them. So giving that choice of none of the above seems like a logical way to let voters vote. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thatcher, I would not want to you to think that the undervote in your election meant that those voters who didn't vote for you thought that none of the above was the appropriate answer. I really think that sometimes voters might actually not have an opinion on a particular office, and so including none of the above might give them an opportunity to say some things that maybe shouldn't be said. I mean, sometimes genteelness brings us to a better society.
Thank you, Representative Dalto.
I just had a curiosity. What would happen if the none of the above
one?
slot one. Would you hold a revote?
Well, what I think...
Not you, but I mean...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. What I think it does is just it makes it clear that they purposely didn't vote. So there's no room for anybody deciding
and I know that this would never happen in any of our county elections office, of enhancing another vote for somebody. It just makes it very clear that they purposely did not want either one of those options.
It also states that a vote cast for none of the above does not count in determining the number of votes cast for a candidate or for against the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a question?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just want to push on this. If somebody doesn't vote at all, there's no chance of enhancing it, right? I mean, there's only a chance of enhancement if they make some other mark. But it would seem that we ought to, I mean, if we're going to go this way, we need to do something with none of the above, because that's a vote and it ought to count. And, I mean, if it really is none of the above and we're going to go this way, it would seem to me we ought to disqualify the person who's running and get some more candidates. I mean, wouldn't that seem right to you?
Yeah,
I would suggest, you, Representative, if that's your intent with House Bill 3343, that LC is at the end of the hall and amendments can be drafted.
Only if you intend to hear the bill. Would I waste the time with that?
That's my prerogative.
Yeah, you can give me a little clue on it because you're going to hear it again.
I'll give you the sign. Thank you, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you.
Eugene Schoenheit? Please come forward, and thank you for traveling more than 100 miles to be here. Oh, it was less than 100. Ah, so you snuck one in on me on the sign-in sheet. Welcome anyway.
That's a long way from you.
Okay, I need to clarify a couple things. I wrote this bill at request of
Jerry Bitts, who worked on election integrity project, and pretty much, you know, she kept talking about, well, this isn't right about the process, and so I found a way to fix it. This particular way of doing things has been done in Nevada since 1975, and I, from what I understand, they put this on their ballot if they have a point of none and above. And as far as the number of votes, when you start talking none and above, any person, you know, could get a half a dozen votes. They could get 1,600 none and above, but they're still going to win the election because it just doesn't count. And the reason we did it this way was because of all the controversy in the past, because when you start talking about none of the above as an option for people, well, maybe they don't want this person, well, then who? And it becomes a real big problem, although, you know, it's possible to change this in the future, but Don McIntyre tried this on a statewide vote here 2 years ago, and it went down. So this is pretty much the simple way to fix a problem, and the main thing about this is, you know, you know, we can talk about specks of dirt. That's an important point. We can talk about interpretation. But when you have the ballot and you have two candidates and none above, and the elector marks it properly, there's no way that ballot can be changed. And, I mean, we hear this from political parties. One party will say, oh, yeah, well, they're messing with the election. The other party will say the same thing, go back and forth. This just basically makes it equal. And I think the thing is, you know, and this transfers it to the elector, because, and then there's some other aspects too. People who are elderly, under care, when they, you know, fill out their ballot, they may mark it one way. If they don't, you know, somebody else, you know, handles parts of it, you know, can write it in. There's, you know, all kinds of variations. But, you know, if the person just marks it, it's done, nobody can change it. And that's the purpose of this bill.
Right. Sure. Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I mean, when you make the purpose that clear, I wonder whether we ought to consider a wording change. I mean, it would seem to me no preference is different than none of the above.
I had thought about that, and that's okay, too. No preference.
I mean, if that's really what you're suggesting, then no preference really ought to not count. None of the above is an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
That it's a no vote for those people. Yeah.
Well, I'm you know, feel that that's okay. I did include this into the measures too, because a lot of times there's measures, and also the was pointed out to me that, well, how many people, you know, single people run for office? And I went ahead and looked into that and found that most single people, or say single people on a ballot who run for office, is going to be either judges or maybe school board or water district or whatever, that it, from, you know, state representative on up, there's always competition one way or another.
When you say single people,
I mean single candidate.
Oh,
for a district.
For a second, I'm going to have to defend the honor of Representative Dolfo down there, and myself,
and me,
and Representative Mark. I don't know where you're going with this single people thing, but all right, Representative Farr, back on track.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is more a comment than a question, but 2 years ago, during the election process, I talked with a friend of mine. I was very surprised to find out that she and her husband had never registered to vote, yet she's my age. And part of the reason that she hadn't is she believed that you had to vote in each election, that you had to vote for each candidate and each measure. And she said, you know, we just don't always understand what the measure means. We don't, you know how to vote. And I said, well, you don't have to vote. If you don't know anything about a candidate, you just simply don't have to vote in that specific election. And so in many ways, I do agree that this could be a very clean way to allow people that did not want to choose to vote yes or no on a measure, or to vote for either candidate or one candidate, to say, I have no preference, or no opinion. No preference, no opinion. I guess that I agree with Representative Greenlick that none of the above may not be the best way to go about stating you don't want to make a choice. But I do like no opinion or no preference.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you write one of these up on a weekend, and then it sounded great at the time, but no preference is okay.
I've done the same thing.
Yeah.
So,
and this is not the first advertisement I did on this either.
And Eugene, I appreciate you traveling here to be here and testifying on behalf of this, and I think that this is one of those ways to address those potential specks of dirt on ballots that we deal with frequently. So thank you.
Okay. And Jerry Bitz is going to probably like to add to this. And
yeah, I've got them on my list. I skipped you because you checked that you traveled more than 100 miles. So
can't even trust non-candidate.
Exactly. None of the above. Jerry Bitz and Alice Bruning, do you wish to testify together? That'd be great. You're not going to bash on single people, are you? Okay. Then go ahead and come forward. You can state your name for the record. That'd be great.
I'm Jerry Bitz from Clackamas County, and I was chair of the Election Integrity Project for the past 3 years. Vote by mail has been about 6 years, hasn't it?
95, 96.
Anyway, in 2002, in the primaries, the first time that we put together a team of people to go do some poll watching at the elections offices. I used to work on the election boards before we did vote by mail. And there would be an equal representation of parties at the our polls. And we had, the election was only 12 hours, a 12-hour day, and we knew our neighbors. We knew who were coming in and out, and we had absolute control of the ballot boxes. And there was a lot to be said for that. And after 3 years or so of the vote by mail, there was a lot of questions. People out there didn't know where their ballots were going off to. And we decided we wanted to see what was going on. So we put together a team and went and looked into it. There's a lot of things to be concerned for. And I understand that our county clerks are very, all 36 counties, that the county clerks are very satisfied with the way they're doing the job. And they are doing a good job, but there's potential for things to go wrong. And the very first time that we observed. In fact, Alice was on the first committee the first team that went in to observe on that. She and her husband were there as the very first observers, poll watchers. And she saw something there that disturbed her, and she reported it to me. What she saw was one of the people who were on the board processing the ballots, which were also, they were doing this 7 days before the election. One of them was using a tool similar to this. It was like a big paper clip that was sprung out like this, only it was much smoother. This one's crooked because I just took a big paper clip to show you. It had a handle. It had a wooden handle so that it looked like a real efficient, real professional tool. And he was using that tool on their punch ballots to take out chads. And when she told me about that, I was on the next shift. And so I asked the supervisor about that, and she went and got the tool and showed it to me and told me why it was acceptable. And she took a blank ballot, and she showed me why it was necessary. She tried to show me why it was necessary. She said, we're allowed to use this tool where the chad is broken on 2, 3, or 4 corners. Well, I'll tell you, a chad that's broken on all four corners is not there. And a chad that's broken on 3 is hanging, and it just needs to be tapped, and it falls off. And if it's broken on 2, it flops down, and it can be brushed off. There was no reason to use a tool like this, and she couldn't show me why there was. It disappeared. It may have been used for 3 years. We don't know. That was the first time we saw it, and it disappeared. It wasn't there anymore. Now we don't have punch cards, but we still have pencils and pens, and we still have enhancing going on. There's for counting the votes by machine, they say that they have to enhance anything that has just a little check or a little hex. It doesn't it's not going to go through the machine and be counted. Well, I was on the phone thing with 36 counties this time, where you're listening to everybody's comments. One of our election integrity people from another county said that they had, when they ran the test through the machine, that some of the ballots were voting where there was no vote. And they checked those things out, where the circles were that you fill in. They were wider on one side than they were on another. And it picked that up. Well, those ballots had to be pulled out, and they got new ballots. I don't know how many of them was that way, but just consider that.
I don't want to interrupt you. If you could just
move it on.
Well, I get your point.
Okay.
I think the committee does, and I just want to make sure everybody has time to testify.
Okay.
With the half an hour that we've allotted for this bill, so that's if you could just.
Okay, well, you've seen me before, and you're probably seeing me again because there's other bills coming up on the same subject. There's some that are have more to them than this. My main concern is the ballot enhancing and altering of the ballots. I don't like that at all, and I don't like to see them opened early. But I do think that this is one of the things that could help, to have none of the above. And I don't mind having the words none of the above. It's so easy to understand. Anybody can understand it's none of the above. And it's not always people. Sometimes it's and most of the time, it's probably some issue. And you might want none of the above.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, what I had to say was very much the same. I'm the one that saw it going on and reported it. Alice Bruning.
Thank you.
So mine would only be repetition of the same fact.
So you can say ditto.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Seeing that. Enhance your testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you so much for coming down
and testifying today. We'll see you soon, I'm sure. I'm looking forward to it. Annette, I find it's hard to believe you're opposing a bill I'm hearing. My personal goal is to find one that you support.
There's plenty. You're just not hearing them.
Touché.
Annette Newingham, Lane County elections official, on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. And this is House Bill 3343. We are in opposition. I'll just be brief. I think that the concerns we had was dealing with sort of administrative questions. Section 1, it was really kind of unclear what problem we were fixing with the bill. Currently, if a voter does not want to vote for any candidate or measure on the ballot, they are not obligated to do so, and the ballot is not invalidated should a voter not vote on one or more contests or measures. This bill requires that each contest and measure include an additional line for none of the above, increasing the size of the ballot. This could be a substantial cost at a primary, general, and special district election with candidates. The increased cost would result on whether another back page would need to be required, or even another second page, two ballots being sent to a voter if it didn't fit on the one. And the increased cost could also affect, it has to do with the size of the ballot, and whether you need to accommodate all of them. There's the postage, because if you increase it to size 16, or we have different types of ballot systems, there's limits to how long you can make your ballot within the confines of the election system, and that's when we flip it over to the back side. At the last general election, we actually could not even print all of the text of the measures. We had only put the question and the ballot title, and had to put another insert in for the state measures because there wasn't room. So this does have a real issue to us. This special district election that is coming up in Lane County, I have currently 256 ballot styles with all the precincts and ballot combinations, and we go over three columns. If you added an additional line on every one of those contests of none of the above, it does lengthen the ballot. That's an absolute. It would affect possibly the postage issue of mailing it out. If you go over an ounce, it would be 55 cents for voters who are having to return the ballots back, and we do our very best to try to keep it within 37 cents because people are very sensitive of that issue. We would also have to, on Section 6, it talks about the additional instructions on none of the above option, which also adds to the ballot size. And it's also unclear whether it would mean, what it would mean if the voter didn't mark none of the above, if they choose not to vote on a contest or measure, because it instructs them that they need to vote on none of the above if they don't vote on a contest or measure. And we know that voters don't always follow directions. There's also concern that adding the additional instructions that marking none of the above will not count as a vote will add to voter confusion, increasing the likelihood of a voter not marking the ballot correctly to reflect their intent. We just urge your careful consideration of those concerns that we bring forward to you. And if you have any questions.
Thank you, Annette. Thank you for being here. And whether you agree with me on bills or not, I always appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Chair Kidd.
Are there any questions? Representative Farr.
Annette, I have a question for you regarding the cost. I think that was something that probably hadn't really been considered. Is there any way that you could look at a ballot and, you know, a current ballot, and you could see what would need to be done to add no preference or none of the above to each of the categories, just to see if it would fit?
Chair Kitts and Representative Farr, yes, it's more complicated. Like I mentioned, we have 256 ballot styles for the May special district election coming up. So every one of them is a little different. Some actually only go like two columns, so there's certainly room for a third column and it wouldn't be an issue, and so there'd be no really cost affected there. But some of them go all three columns, so there's it's sometimes difficult to equate exactly what that cost would be. You'd have to really go to the election, add a line on each one, then it sorts it out. We have systems that sort that out to figure out how that layout is going to occur, and then we have to make those decisions. An example of that is the general election. we would go through the ballot style, then we go, oops, it's not fitting. And so then we back off, and then we say we need to take off the text of the summary on the measures in order to get it, and then we try again until we do all these various things to try to get everything to fit. It just would lengthen the ballot and just reduces the options available to us. In some cases, it probably wouldn't exceed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative March.
Thank you. And I'm maybe a little unclear with this language here. So looking at the bill, Section 2, Subsection 4, cast for none of the above does not count in determining the number of votes cast for a candidate for or against a measure. So if someone marked Richard Burke, for example, as for governor, and then also marked none of the above. Well, of course, that's not a major, but it also doesn't count for candidates. But let's go back to just a yes, no, and none of the above. If someone marks yes and none of the above, and this says here that the none of the above doesn't count, then the yes still counts?
Chair Kitts and members of the committee, that is actually one of the questions that goes back to some of the enhancing things that are brought up. There are issues that have to have decisions, and that's what we use the vote-by-mail manual for. When those reoccurring type of issues that voters do, because voters don't always follow directions. When you reach the population at whole, there's oftentimes a different degree of understanding. We try to keep things simple, but they're going to make mistakes. I don't care what system. I've been doing it since 1990. They always make mistakes, and you have to determine voter intent. And if it's clear, and if it's not clear, then you let it stand by whatever ends up happening. But those decisions would have to be made. So it would add another component, and the Secretary of State's office with the clerks would have to try to determine what you would do under different things that if they marked none of the above and then they voted up for a candidate, or if they wrote in a candidate, they're going to do all those combinations.
Thank you.
Commissioner Thatcher.
As I understand it right now, if somebody writes in Mickey Mouse and checks, let's just go way back, Dukakis or something, then you are actually counting it as an overvote because you're counting a vote for Mickey Mouse and you're counting a vote for Dukakis because under the fictitious name rule, somehow that made, you know, there's a vote for Mickey Mouse.
I think in that case, there would be two votes for Dukakis.
Yeah. Well, what my point is why couldn't you by rule just establish that if they're marking none of the above and a candidate, that it would be an overvote and it would just it'd be...
Chair Kitts and Representative Thatcher. Certainly, that would be exactly what we would attempt to do, is to try to define things based on what is given to us. But there will be circumstances, I can assure you, that will not be as cut and dry as it makes it sound, because voters give you all those kind of combination. Sometimes it's pretty, they might put a mark saying, I made a mistake, I didn't mean to mark none of the above. You're going to have to duplicate or enhance that ballot because they've made it very clear, oops, they made a mistake. It could be the same thing as if they marked Representative Thatcher and then they marked the other person you're running against and they put, oops, I didn't mean to put the other one. I really want Representative Thatcher. You would want us to reflect their intent.
Follow up?
Well, in that case, it wouldn't be a matter of interpreting. It would be very clear. And it's also very clear when somebody marks Mickey Mouse and Dukakis, in this example, that that they're voting for both. And therefore, it was like an example of a protest vote that I was talking about before. Since you don't have that choice of none of the above, that sometimes people are just canceling their own vote out on purpose. And so, just take it as it is.
Chair Kitts, Representative Thatcher, that's a very good point. I would first of all say that we don't make changes, enhancements, without the intent being clear. And you're right, that for only those circumstances that are clear, we don't make those decisions. And there are two members of opposite party affiliation, if not more, their opposite party affiliation to make that decision so that there's a check and balance in that process to make sure that the intent is clear when ballots are enhanced. The other point is that I'd love to see a change to Mickey Mouse. The problem, you know, we do a lot of hand tallying of ballots for Mickey Mouse and Saddam Hussein and all those wonderful individuals, and I find that a real, you know, very distasteful. And but we do our job, and the reason for that ambiguity, you might say, is because unfortunately people do name their kids with names that you would think are fictitious. And they're not.
Charlie Brown?
Well, yes, and so it's not always easy to ascertain that it's a real or not person. And we also don't want to take it upon us to make that decision, and be, you know, when we don't know. And it's a hard thing to keep that checks and balance sometimes. But we want to do the right thing.
Great. Thank you. Seeing no further questions, appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Last person I'll call at this time is Richard Burke, who I know will keep it brief since we're already 4 minutes beyond the allotted time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Richard Burke. I'm Executive Director of the Libertarian Party of Oregon. The reason I wanted to testify on this bill is because within our party, we use none of the above now. In all of our elections for internal party office, we have none of the above as an option, and we also have abolish this office, which is interesting. And for nominations to public office, we have none of the above. And this impacted me, because when I ran for governor in 98, our party was divided on how to do politics, whether to flavor it with more street activism or go the more professional political route. And I defeated none of the above by 2 votes in that convention because of that division.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just a resounding mandate coming out of my party that year. We solidified behind the latter school of thought now. But anyway, I think this is very good, because even if people do not use the none of the above option, I think it's nice for them to have the choice. I think that the question of cost is a little bit of a red herring. I know for local nonpartisan offices, there are oftentimes many candidates that run. And so by that logic, we should now limit the number of candidates that run for fear that we print a ballot that is too long or too confusing. Postage, same issue. If we have a long municipal primary ballot, you know, what are we going to do? I think that it's an important responsibility of government to give voters all of the choices they can. And with regard to the term of the no preference term, I would say that if anything, this should be an additional one. No preference to me means, well, they're both okay, or all three of them, or four of them are okay. I don't care. It tells us that they paid attention to the race and they have confidence in all of the people that are running. Whereas none of the above says just the opposite. I don't have confidence in any of them. Or if they don't vote at all, it means I don't care. I don't even pay attention to this race. And but either way, it provides us with more feedback as to what the voters are actually saying, and it gives voters more choices. And if they have more choices, I would submit to you that they will have more confidence in the system, and by definition, more confidence in the people who are running to become part of the system. So for those reasons, I would strongly affirm on behalf of my party that you support this very good bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and this is just a brief one.
Did you state your name for the record?
I think so.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Governor Burke. Well, at least you beat none of the above.
That's right, I did. That's right.
And in fact, if it sounds from your discussion that you would prefer that none of the above does count towards the election. Is that correct?
Well, I think that at minimum, none of the above should be counted, where we say, you know, Smith got this many, Jones got that many, none of the above got this many. And I think it would be a good litmus test to see how much confidence people do have in the system. I think if by running good candidates, no one will ever be embarrassed. And I think it's just good civics.
Thank you.
I would say that the embarrassment lies in some of the mailers that the other side sends out on one another, not whether or not none of the above is going to be the victor in that race.
Maybe we can see the mailing from none of the above.
Exactly. thank you, Richard, for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I hear your campaign's hard.
Hard campaign.
Door to door.
Colleagues, at this time, we'll be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3343. Colleagues, I have not had a chance to speak with Representative Boquist, and have tried unsuccessfully to get in touch with him, as he is in Revenue Committee at this time. So I will be postponing House Bill 3043 to our next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, at the last hearing, suggested that we get together and discuss another bill that I had that relates to the same issue and maybe combine them. So
yeah, I would suggest that between now and then, Representative, you speak with Representative Boquist about that. If he's agreeable to that, I'm more than happy to wait until the amendments can be drafted before I bring it back up. Please just communicate with my office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thatcher.
I move that to request the Speaker to draft an LC draft regarding Congress to free Oregon agricultural industry from undue regulatory barriers in transportation regulation of commerce.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher requests the Speaker to draft an LC regarding Congress to free Oregon ag industry from undue regulatory barriers in transportation regulation of commerce. Is there any objection?
Just a question?
Yeah, how about if we just drafted the free Oregon period?
Like just make it its own country?
Yeah, get off our back.
Get out of the WTO.
Representative March.
Would this also free Oregon farmers from having to participate in the conservation reserve programs?
My understanding is it's specific to transportation regulation.
Only transportation.
That's my understanding. Thank you, Representative March. Seeing none, so ordered.
Free farmers.
Nice.
Federal subsidy.
Should we amend it to make the state song "Keep on Rocking in the Free World"?
Colleagues, I understand the intent of your discussion, but let's wait till we adjourn before we go further with that. At this time, committee's adjourned.
They're going to come.
They were.